Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators, and we've been working for about the last 25 years. We've worked with just about every major publisher in the business, and together we've published somewhere around 75 books. It always changes. We've all taught illustration at the university level.
Every week we pick a new topic in illustration. Sometimes we agree, sometimes we argue, but each week you guys are going to learn something brand spanking new.
Sounds good. All right, so we are recording this episode actually back in March. We're that far ahead on these. We are just in the beginning of our quarantine, I guess, or self-imposed quarantine. It has been imposed on a national level yet. I don't know. You guys listening to us are in the future, and you're probably thinking, oh, it's so naive, those three illustrators.
Well, there's only 10 people listening to us now.
They have no idea what we've been through. So just take note that everything we discuss today, actually this topic is inspired by what's going on with this virus and the social impact of it. Just know that this is kind of what's inspiring this and what the stage is for this topic today as well. So, also just want to note, welcome. If you have been staying at home to work, welcome to this lifestyle. I see all these people that are like, I'm just imagining like now, so many people don't have a commute. And if you live in LA or maybe you live in New York, you are commuting an hour each way every day. A lot of these people. And so congratulations. Hopefully you're making use of that time. But the fallout that I've seen from that, or the side effects I've seen from that, is there's so many artists that I follow that are posting more and sharing more and using that time to be more creative. So I think that's super cool, and that's a nice trend. It'll be neat to see how this pans out over the next several months. Lee, it's your topic today. You want to take it away?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy stuff going on in the world. Yeah, so I'm just now, Jake was supposed to ask like what's going on in our life now during the coronavirus.
Sorry.
Was going to be my segue, but he blew it. no, it's funny because I was posting on Facebook, seeing what you were just talking about on Facebook, and some people were saying, how are they going to deal with being home and all that stuff? And I responded with saying, yeah, you know, some people, this is the first day of the quarantine for artists. This is just Monday, right. Tuesday. It's just our normal day.
Right. So, except now we have to do it with all the kids home.
Oh, yeah, that's a crazy one. Yeah, so everybody's impacted in different ways. I think I mentioned it before on the podcast that I am opening an art gallery. And, you know, as this thing has progressed, I'm now closing the art gallery. I won't say closing, but I'll say I'm waiting to open indefinitely.
Kind of a failure to launch.
Failure to launch. Yeah, I had it all set up and it was all good to go. But I learned a few lessons through it. And I want to start with the story that that prompted this topic. The topic today is going to be risk and how we all deal with it. It's a good topic for right now anyway, because we're weighing all kinds of different risks and you know, how do you assess risk? I don't hear artists talk about it too much. And so that's why I thought it'd be fun. But here's the scenario that I want to run by you guys. So you can think about it in your head and what would you do? So when I was opening the gallery, the business model for the gallery it started with the idea that being a gallery artist just really sucks. The business model's terrible because typically galleries take 50% and you have to ship your stuff there. And I've never loved that business model for artists. So my idea for the gallery was I'll have a big space. I'll basically what we do at art fairs or if you do Comic Cons or whatever, you rent space there and you can sell whatever you want. You can make as much as you want and you keep all the money. Mm-hmm. And I love that idea that there's a little bit of expense and you can make as much as you want. And it's, I think it's a better business model. And then to boot, the artists we're going to get to be, the local artists we're going to get to work there too. So it would be an office, shared office space, kind of
so
fun.
Cool. Such
yeah,
a good
it's,
idea.
It seemed like just a really fun thing. And I didn't have too much problem filling it up. But when I first got the space, I started contacting people who I thought would be a good fit for that particular business model. Some of them are professional gallery artists because they're perfect and they have a proven sales history and they sell a ton of stuff. So I'll give you a hypothetical. I'm basically taking like 10 people that I talked to and grouping them into one hypothetical person for this. Mm-hmm. So the artist that I contacted said they typically have a show where they make, I'm just making this up, 20 paintings, right? So they show in a gallery, they have 20 paintings. They typically sell maybe half of them, right? And right. Let's say the typical sale is $5,000, just to make the math easy. So mm-hmm. from a show, they've made $50,000, and the gallery takes half of that, which is brutal, but that's what they're used to. That's what artists are used to. Takes half. So the artist keeps $25,000, and then their cost and framing and all that comes out of that. So out of the $50,000, they maybe have made a fraction of that, $20,000 maybe. And these are established artists, by the way, too. I mean, this is a high price point. I'm not saying that everybody's getting $5,000 a painting, but these are the people that I'm talking to, like people who know this business.
Right.
And so I invited them all to be a part of the gallery. And the cost of being in this gallery was between $250 and $550. And that's a month. And then I had a 6-month lease. So the maximum amount that you would spend if you didn't sell anything is around $3,000.
Or $1,500 if you had the 250 space.
Correct. Yeah. But let's assume they went all in to the biggest space I had. So they might be out $3,000. And if they average, selling $50,000 worth of stuff, they have a cost of $3,000. They now walk home with $47,000 instead of $20,000.
Mm-hmm. The you math many... really works. That...
But they all said no. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, I could not believe it. And I was like, why? And the answer was, what if we don't sell anything? And I was like, oh my gosh.
It's you know what? I would say this, that we're not trained to think like entrepreneurs. We're never in our schooling, and most parents don't ever prepare kids to think about spending money that you could lose.
Right.
Because the three of us have lost a lot. And the more times you lose and the more times you fail, but then you have the wins that pay for the failures. Mm-hmm. You kind of are able to do that.
Right. We never have the conversation about it as artists. I told Will and Jake, as I was texting, us three talked back and forth via text a lot. And I said that artists think about how basically the artist mindset is how little can I lose versus how much can I make? Regular entrepreneurs think how much can I make? They don't want to be stupid about it and,
right.
and but they do think, okay, in this business, I can make a bunch of money. If the risk is $3,000 and the gain is, an additional $27,000, that's a pretty good gamble. But I thought it was really weird. And so so most artists never have a chat about it. But then, if you start digging deeper into the way artists do things, mm-hmm. it's even worse because say, for example, a lot of artists that go to traditional schools and then get their master's. And I know because I got my master's degree, a bunch of people I know from that school and from that system that got their master's degrees. Well, artists are willing to throw away, between for undergrad up to $150,000. And then for a graduate school, another, $50,000 to $80,000with mm-hmm. no guarantee of return.
Right.
But they do it willingly. Like it's not even a question. Not that you shouldn't educate yourself. I'm not saying there's not a value there. But I'm just saying how we evaluate what to do and how when mm-hmm. to make a move with business, we don't really talk about it too much. So I'm going to start out with I'm going to walk us through a bunch of stuff and ask Will and Jake a couple of questions. But I've got the top 5 mistakes artists make concerning risk when going into business. Cool. And we'll go over some different scenarios. This is the top 5. I actually have 7, but I like saying top 5. So there's actually 7.
The bonus ones. Yeah, two
sounds
bonus
good.
These would be a 5+2. Okay, so here's what I noticed, and these show up at all different stages, and that's what I can't wait to talk about, because they show up as a student, they show up in different ways. So number one, not understanding startup costs. It's the concept of, if I make a change, it's going to involve some kind of early costs that you don't keep recurring over time. If you say, hey, I'm going to be a student and I'm going to enroll in art school, that involves a certain set of costs. And if you are leaving school and you say, hey, I'm going to be a professional illustrator, that involves a certain set of costs. And if you're an established illustrator and you say, I'm going to change my career, that also involves a certain set of costs. It takes money to be in business, but artists are the only ones who don't want to do that. They don't want to acknowledge that.
It's interesting that to me that writers, I almost think that, and I think I made a YouTube video about this once where I did the comparison between writers, musicians, comedians, anybody who performs. But, you know, we work as illustrators, we work with authors. And it's funny that all of them are more, in my opinion, more entrepreneurial than artists, because they make the product without any contract. They don't have any guarantee that they're going to get paid. Whereas illustrators, and I'm more comparing to illustrators, not gallery artists. Gallery artists are a step further towards the entrepreneurial side. But you know, an author has to write a story. And no publisher might ever buy it. Most authors have probably a ratio of about 5 or 10 to 1. In other words, every 10 stories they write, they sell one of them. Rick Walton was prolific. He had published around 100 books, and he had written about 1,000, a little over 1,000 stories. And that's the whole moving without the ball thing in basketball, that analogy. You're not guaranteed that you're going to get the rock passed to you, right?
Right.
To use a sports analogy. And the same with musicians that are songwriters that are, you know, writing songs. They don't know if their songs are going to take off.
Yeah, it's a gamble.
I think what's interesting, too, is when you shift into just something tangential to illustration, like something like photography, where you're still making images, all of a sudden, so many photographers are entrepreneurial, and they know the value of a website. They know the value of marketing their images and licensing their images and selling their images. They're doing work for hire, but they're also like creating portfolios. And I kind of feel like the illustration world could really stand to just like hang out with photographers more.
I totally agree.
Those guys have it figured out. They got it dialed in.
Yeah, they understand image rights and all that stuff, and like, you know, how to make reproductions and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really got it dialed in. Okay, so number one was not understanding that it takes money to be in business in some way. You got to buy some equipment, you got to do some different stuff, and we'll talk about the specifics of that later. Number two, this is a big one, no proof of concept. Proof of concept is one of the best ways to evaluate risk. Jake, you want to talk about what proof of concept is?
Yeah, so proof of concept is when you actually make like the minimum viable product of a thing, like the minimum viable option of a thing, and test it out to see if it works. And I was actually just talking about this on my YouTube channel recently, in that the example would be is, you've got an idea for like a 3-part graphic novel, an epic story. Maybe you're a writer, maybe you're an artist, whatever. You've got this epic that you want to tell. It's like a Lord of the Rings or Star Wars. And so instead of killing yourself over the next 5 years to write out this thing and to submit it to a publisher, take a month, take your main character and do a short story with them and throw it out there into the world. It's 10 pages long, it's 20 pages long, something like that, and just see what people think about it. And immediately people say, I really like this character. You know, what's the next thing? What happens next? Where, you know, who are they? What are they going to do? I love this world. Or they're going to yawn and not say anything. And either way, you've got an answer of whether you should move forward with this or not. So, minimum means what's the smallest thing that you could do. Viable means what's the, you know, adding that to minimal means what still works as, something that you could present. And then product is what it's used. Initially what this is used for is startup companies and software companies, but you could do, the product could be what's something actual tangible that you can deliver to somebody, whether it's, you know, something physical or something digital or something like that. Somebody can actually point to it, download it, consume it. And once you've got that in hand, you've got basically something you can, what would you call it? Test out. What was the name of this one exactly?
Proof of concept.
Proof of concept. That's right.
So Lee, what was your proof of concept with the gallery?
That's a good question. Another idea that goes with proof of concept is the idea of scaling up. And so I took away my number six and just I'm combining it there. Proof of concept and scaling up. So my proof of concept is I started 10 years ago with a super small booth at a convention that cost me $50 to get in. And I sold some stuff and I didn't sell some other stuff. And I looked at those two things and said, okay, what sold and what didn't sell? And then I modified it for the next show and the next show and the next show. Excuse me. And then I did bigger art fairs and sold more, started selling originals. What sells? What doesn't sell? Then I opened a gallery and that really only had one really busy day a year in Portland. One busy day a month. It was an art walk kind of thing. And we sold some that night, but we realized we didn't have enough foot traffic. And so I started paying attention to that. So I started scaling. I sold one thing 10 years ago, and then I sold two things, and then I sold three things, and I gradually scaled up to now, where I know what sells, I know what the ingredients are for things to sell, and I've done it a lot. I've sold over and over in different geographical regions and at different price points, and so that's why I felt comfortable making a leap with a huge commitment versus just saying, you know, starting out and saying, okay, I'm going to open an art gallery just out of the blue.
Right. So in software, the example is you want to get a consumer from point A to point B, and you have an idea for a car, a new design of car that's going to get them from point A to point B, but instead of spending all this time developing the wheels, developing the chassis, developing the seats and all that, what you're going to do is first make a skateboard, the skateboard version. And that skateboard is going to get them from point A to point B. And if people like that and say, hey, this really works, what can we do to improve this? Then you're going to add handlebars to it and turn it into a scooter, see if that works. And once that works, you're going to add pedals to it and turn it into a bike, and then add an engine to it, and then add another set of wheels, and then build out a car from that. I mean, obviously, a skateboard company isn't going to turn into Tesla, but for purposes of this, you want to get a person from point A to point B, not see how efficient you can do that and build on top of that instead of working on one component of the final product.
Right. Perfect example. That's number two. The number three is not running cost and income projections. This is a big one. This was a huge deal when I decided to do my Kickstarter because I had no experience. So I didn't have too much of a proof of concept on whether Kickstarter would work. So I went to number three.
What'd you kickstart?
It was my book of all my work, basically. It was
the Art of Lee White.
Art of, yeah.
Yeah.
But I didn't have any, you know, it's hard to do proof of concept if you haven't done anything like it before. There's always a leap at some point. And so, you know, all of these things sometimes work for a project, or sometimes only you're going to be able to pick one or two of these things, but you have to be able to assess risk in some way. So what I did for my Kickstarter was my cost income projections. I basically made three columns. What is the worst case scenario? What is a probable scenario? And what's a best case scenario? And that's how I started doing the research. What does an average book do? How many do they sell? What's an average shipping cost? And how many do they sell to different countries? And you know, I was even asking you guys some of those questions, trying to figure out how do I populate this spreadsheet for for figuring out cost and income? And that's what I feel like these gallery artists that I approach failed to do. They only looked at the cost side. I might lose this a little bit of money. Instead of saying, I mean, it was a little bit of money to lose, a lot of money to gain. That's a great equation for saying, okay, I'm going to try this out.
Right.
I had a friend who, he's a well-known illustrator. Still a friend. And he, back in the day, this is definitely going to date me, but back in the day when we advertised in the source books, like Showcase and Workbook, that's how we advertised in those books because the internet wasn't a thing. And we paid to put our artwork in there. It was like a telephone directory for illustration. But the same thing, he, you know, I went in and the first year, I think I made two or three times my money back. And a page, just one page, was like $3,000 in this book annually. And then the next year, I got two pages, and it was, the cost came down a little bit, and it was like, I think it was like $5,500 to buy two pages a spread. And I remember talking to him and he's like, oh, I could never spend that much money. And I know he was making more than I was at the time, you know? And, yeah. And I'm like, but on the two, and this is after I had the results back on the two page spread, I made about eight times what it cost me. So it cost me about $5,500 and I calculated about $40,000 off of that ad.
Dang.
You know, wow. In commissions.
That's great. Yeah. That's from fantastic.
Yeah. From different, advertisers that, you know, I was doing a lot of advertising illustration at the time. And I remember telling him, in my mind, I was like, well, he just doesn't know. Wait till I tell him the numbers. And I told him the numbers. He's like, yeah, I couldn't risk that amount of money. And I remember saying, don't you think you're risking $35,000? You know, if your results were similar to mine, right. Isn't that right. A bigger risk?
It's a great point.
So
that's, yeah.
But I do think we have to work into, you know, you talked about the cost benefit analysis or doing projections, right?
Yeah. Same
and,
idea.
And I think that I've embarked on certain projects and I've tried to imagine what it's going to be. And I didn't have enough experience in that particular project in that particular market to get even a rough estimate. You know, I was going in completely blind, but I think a big addition to this particular point is how many little things you've done. So like you did, you know, you, for the gallery, you did little shows and then you did bigger shows and then you did bigger shows and you did the shows that the kind of tent art fair shows that you have to get juried into. You can't just pay your money and get into them. You have to submit your stuff.
Right.
And the jury has to say, yes, you're in. So now you're getting validation from a jury saying, we think you'll do well here. They don't want anybody that's not doing well.
Right.
Right.
And so you had that going for you. And I think if anyone's listening, if you're embarking on a project, this is really where, if you have no idea how much to even project, this is where starting really small and doing little projects is going to give you, like, it, like if I could give anybody advice on doing a crowdfunding project like Kickstarter,
yeah,
I would say if you have this project you've been dreaming about and you just know it's going to do well, or you just really feel like it's going to do well and you're really excited about it, you might want to do a tiny project first on Kickstarter and kickstart it, like a deck of cards or you know, something where you only need to raise $1,000 or a couple $1,000.
That's such good advice because, and actually before I ever launched a Kickstarter, I had been doing like my version of Kickstarter, which is, I think, why the reason of Kickstarter was created, because there's so many people doing this, where I'd basically say, hey, I've got a new sketchbook coming out, and it's going to cost $20, but I can't get it printed until I have some upfront money. So this is a pre-order only. and you won't get your book until, you know, 2 months from now. So if you want to pre-order it today, there's a special incentive for pre-ordering it. I'd throw in something a little extra, you know, usually a hand drawing. I'd do like a little sketch for everybody. But that got me already in that mindset, like, you know, this is a little bit of risk I'm doing up front, and I'm going to be on the hook for this money, so I better make it work. But it was always something that was within my there's an uncomfortable zone, and then there's like a no-go zone, and then there's a comfort zone, and that uncomfortable zone in the middle is where you need to be. And so it has right. to be where you're uncomfortable, but it still makes sense, right? And if it doesn't, if it goes south, you're not gonna, you know, you're not gonna be in dire straits. You know, you might be out time you put into it. You might be out a certain budgeted amount that you put into it, but you're not gonna not be able to pay your mortgage, right? And so that's like the zone that I want to be in before I actually launch something. And man, Kickstarter like put rocket engines onto that like system, where I was just using PayPal for like 10 years. I just had a PayPal thing, and I said, here's the PayPal link. If you want this book, it's available. And when Kickstarter came along, it, you know, I remember one person getting, like when I first saw Kickstarter, somebody got $12,000 upfront for a book. And I was like, oh my gosh, they won the lottery. I cannot believe they made that much money. Like, and so, and then I launched my book maybe 6 months later, and it did 86,000, something like that. And I was like, it rewired my brain basically, where I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize what was possible. I also didn't know what I was doing on that scale. And so I was really in over my head and ended up losing some money on that. But I learned a ton of stuff that I've been able to like, basically proof of concept. I realized, okay, this is a watering hole I can return to if I know what I'm doing, and it might actually work.
Does it bug you at all that you didn't invent Kickstarter?
You know, not until you mentioned that just now, Will.
Well, yeah. Kickstarter is a unique environment in that they take, you know, as I look through my list here, Kickstarter really did take out a lot of the risk here for people. If it doesn't fund, you're not out anything. Your startup costs get funded by the Kickstarter itself. The Kickstarter is its own proof of concept. You know, there's different cost projections, obviously, within that. So it's sort of an amazing business model, in my opinion. It's really cool. I want to go to the next one because it segues it right into what Jake was just saying about being able to, you know, how deep do you go? And that's my number four is not where students mess up or where artists mess up is not having a stop limit. Mm-hmm. And I always encourage people to have a stop. If you're going to incur risk, it's like going to begin gambling in Vegas. You have to have a limit that you're going to stop at. Say, I'm willing to go down this much, $500, $1,000, whatever that is. But you need to have that. And so I thought I would
Lee, what's your Vegas stop limit? Just curious.
I got to check my balance on my credit cards. I do tend to, I get really lucky a lot. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, depending on how that luck's working out, I have a high stop limit.
your stop limit was pulled this time with a worldwide pandemic, I think.
Yeah. I did bail on the gallery. I didn't even know if I mentioned that at the start. I hit my stop limit with this virus. It all of a sudden, the variables became higher than the knowns. Mm-hmm. And that's when I pulled it. But I'll show you guys, because you know, as we talk about some of these things, we're at a different point in our career than a lot of people listening. And I want to give some examples of how the practical sides of this stuff. So I had a stop. I had all these things basically in how I approached going to college. And I thought I'd lay it out real quick, with stop limit being the one I'll stop at here. I wanted to go to Art Center, but it was way too expensive. I mean, the $100,000 education, you need to be able to stomach a worst case scenario. I was not okay taking out that much in loans. I just wasn't. Right. And that doesn't even include living costs or anything like that. That was too much. So my plan was, in order to scale up and do all that stuff that we talked about, is I would start at community college get some general education stuff out of the way and start my art training. Then I applied to a school in Laguna Beach, and that was an easier one to get into. It was cheaper, and I got a scholarship. The competition was way less. And so that was stepping stone number one. That was how I started. That was my proof of concept, basically. I had a little bit of money given to me, and the cost was very, very low. And while I was there, my goal was to two things, both get the Cal Grant, which is a huge source of income for students in California, and it's just based on GPA, and then get a scholarship into Art Center. That was going to be my next, basically, proof of concept. And I got the Cal Grant, and I got a half scholarship for basically starting second term of Art Center. And so my stop limit at Art Center was, and I mean, at this point I have a lot of the education paid for, and I still wasn't comfortable with how much I would be spending. So I said, if I don't get full scholarship within two terms, I'll drop out.
Wow.
And I got it the next term. I got the full scholarship. And so, but I had all those things in place, and that's how I ended up with no debt from college, zero.
That's incredible. That's really cool.
It's neat that these things work all the way through in a way to assess what you should do. Should you do it or should you not do it? I mean, that's all the way through it. Let me go through the last two, and then I'll ask you guys some questions. And we'll get into more times where we've had to deal with this. Okay. So the last two, number five, is not understanding opportunity costs. You guys want to go into opportunity cost, or do you want me to explain that?
Well, somebody that was kind of what I was talking about with the story of, you know, not spending money on the source book, advertising my art in the catalog. You know, I'm looking down the barrel of $5,000 or $6,000. And that's at the time, you know, when I did that, it was tough, but I did buy one page first and it did pay off. And so I was relatively confident that if I really make a splash, and boy, buying two pages was better than buying one. My return on investment, my ROI was much higher.
Right.
And the cost would have been saying goodbye to $35,000. That's the opportunity cost.
Right.
In that particular situation. And I've bumped up against that a lot with looking at various projects.
It's crazy to me. You brought this up in our text thread a couple of weeks ago, how I use Adobe products so much. Like, everything that I do for clients runs through some Adobe product. And yet artists are so reluctant to shell out, well, how much is it a month? $50 a month at the most? For the Creative Cloud, right?
Right. And that's a great example.
And it's like my brother-in-law, he just got into the vending machine business. And part of that was, you know, he started going around and he has, I don't know how many hundred different vending machines. But he started going around and he realized, oh, I can't do this without like a moving van. I need to buy a moving van. So he bought a moving van, and I don't know exactly how he got the money, whether he got a loan or something, but he's like, this is necessary for me to do this business that I have. And yeah, it hurt a little bit, but he's like, you know, that's what I got to do in order to do it. And there's so many artists that are just like, I can't afford to spend any money on anything to, right, to do my business. Oh, I don't want to buy that expensive printer, even though, you know, 20 prints selling at what prints usually sell at could pay for the printer, you know,
right.
And people don't want to spend, you know, the extra money on a scanner, even though, like, I bought an expensive, large format scanner, because I was spending so much time like stitching together, comic pages. I was scanning these big pieces of artwork, and then every comic page I'd had to stitch them together. And I did that for two graphic novels. And I was like, you know what? The amount of time that I spent just stitching images together in Photoshop, and if I go by my day rate that I that I charge other clients, I would have paid for a scanner over, right, you know, two or three times over. Right. So So as soon as I saved up some money and I bought that scanner, which was a couple $1,000s, and it has made my life completely easier, made the whole creative process more efficient. And so it's just, my advice is, sometimes you want to make money, you got to spend money.
That's exactly right. And that's, I'm glad you hit on that time is a great thing to value when you're evaluating opportunity costs. To give a definition to opportunity costs, what I have here is it's basically what opportunity am I saying no to by saying yes to this other thing? Mm-hmm. And so Jake was basically saying, no, I don't want to create more work. I need to tile all these things together. That's more important. But he was actually costing himself money by doing that. And the same mm-hmm. thing would be true. Like if I need to get ready for a show, if I'm bagging up prints, which is a very low level job, then I'm not painting, which is a high level. That's where I make more money. And so it's better mm-hmm. for me to pay an assistant to bag the prints so I can actually make more painting. Now there's a risk. Maybe I don't sell the painting and now I'm out the money. But whatever you say yes to means you're saying no to something else. And so you can't, you just got to watch out for being overly cheap. And this is, artists fall into this so badly that they end up costing themselves so much time and effort instead of just doing the easy thing that might be slightly more expensive. You don't want to go nuts and spend and have a huge cost of living increase to do these things. But, you got to balance it. Which brings me to my last one, which is to go into business, you have to be willing to lose. And it's just a weird thing. I would just tack this on to the end, because if you're not willing to lose the money, you're going to be too tight in all of this stuff, in all of your business. Not that you should be frivolous or careless with what you're doing. You do need to evaluate it like this. But, up until when this crazy virus got out of control, I sent Will and Jake a text. I said, I'm okay losing money in the short term. It's a good idea. I have proof of concept. It'll make money. And I have a stop limit on what that number is. But just being okay with losing a little bit to try things out and to do different stuff, changes how things work.
Can I add on to that?
Yeah, please, please.
So I think there's a shift that has to occur. Well, I can speak for myself that when growing up, when I would get money, because I had a paper route, and I worked at McDonald's mm-hmm. and I did those at the same time. And I looked at money because I was living at home with my parents. I didn't pay rent. This is before I left for college. I looked at money as what it could buy for fun. So mm-hmm. every chunk of money I got, I was like, that's a stereo. I need a new stereo. That's a new bicycle. That's mm-hmm. tires for my car. It was all about saving up for, I got to have my going out to eat money. I got to have my whatever, and this was before video games, but I'm sure I know a lot of my students have like, this is my video game money. This is my move going out to the movies money. And I think my point is we get kind of conditioned to look at money that way. And then we become an adult, and then all of a sudden we have rent and utilities and, car insurance and different things. And all of a sudden it's like almost an overload to people that are young, where it's like, my money's supposed to go for fun. right. And now it's got to go for this other stuff. So then I think that's where a lot of artists kind of clamp down and go, I'm not going to lose any more. I'm already losing mm-hmm. it to rent, utilities, blah, 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 this, that, and the other. And I got to be able to still keep my other passions alive, going out to eat, video game, whatever.
Right.
And I think what we're talking about is training your brain to see money a little differently. I think I can speak for myself, but I think for you guys too. I look at money as a tool. And I think that in order to become successful as an artist, really successful as an artist, you have to become more entrepreneurial. And the way you do that is you start to see money as more than what it can buy for you for pleasure. Mm-hmm. You see it more as what it can get you.
How it can work
for you. How it can work for you. So for instance, when I first got out of school, we were told by some of our teachers that if you want to get freelance work, you got to be willing to send out some kind of mailer, like a postcard or something. And I remember sending out my first postcard, and I remember I only sent out 50 But they were, and they actually weren't postcards. They were full pages and they were put in envelopes and I had to pay for the bigger stamps. This was before I realized how much cheaper a postcard would be. But I remember taking it, you know, going to the Kinko's and getting stuff printed off and buying the envelopes and then buying the postage stamps. And the whole time, the little voice, the little, you know, devil on my shoulders, like, you're throwing money away. This money could be used for going to the movies, going to out to eat, playing game, you know, going and doing any buying a stereo, whatever. And you're just going to throw it away. Cause I had no proof of concept. I had no faith.
Right.
But I had to make that first. And that actually was the hardest purchase that I ever made. And yet it was probably like $300 or $400 at the most, you know, but it was one of the hardest purchases I ever made. And I got a huge return on investment. You know, it really worked.
Right.
I got a bunch of jobs. And from then it just made it so much easier. And every time I go to the postcard, that little voice would just get smaller and smaller. I'd still be there. But then the other voice would come in and say, shut up. You've made all this money last time. How can you afford not to do it this time?
Right. Well, you started thinking about value. I mean, you got a good value. And that's been the biggest shift over my career that I've learned is that you start to look for value. It might be expensive to do something, but is the value high or cheap to do it? And where's the value? I don't want to waste money. And I've seen people, there's so many times I've seen people err on the side of being cheap, overvaluing, you know, the value of something. An example of that is this is a good one. When students are in school, they pay for a semester, and because it's per semester, not per class, like once you're taking a quote full-time load, they'll take like 6 full-time classes and have a job because, hey, I'm in 6 classes. I'm going to finish 2 terms early. Mm-hmm. But then the value is not there because if the goal when you're in school is to end up with a solid portfolio or skill set, and that should be the only goal if you're in school, not the diploma. Although the diploma is a great little side thing. If you're burning through all these classes, what ends up happening is they don't have enough time to do the assignments. And then they're C-level students at best. And most of the time they start failing classes because there's no way you can do 6 studio classes in a term.
Right.
So they valued the cheapness of and quantity over the actual value, you know? And so once you start using that as a metric, it starts to sort of change how you make decisions.
Yeah, that's true. I remember I remember adding up how much money I'd spent on shipping 1 year. And now I've gotten used to that number, but it was a very healthy 5-figure number. Wow. And I was just like, holy cow, like, do I get like a special like executive suite at the post office when I show up? Is there some sort of platinum club member for spending this much on postage? But I realized, you know, like like that number is directly related to everything that I've sold. And that means, you know, the higher the shipping amount, the better I'm doing as an artist. And so I got comfortable with those huge shipping amounts. It used to be like every time I click that buy more shipping button, I was just like cringing, like, oh, there goes the money. But I was like, nope, I got to ship these packages out. And this is part of doing business.
I just ordered a huge supply of paper and inks for my printer for prints for shows and stuff. Same thing. Clicking that buy button and you're like, I haven't sold any of these prints yet. I don't know if any of them will sell. And every time I cringe when I'm clicking it, but sure enough, slowly but surely I go through the rolls and I go through the inks and that means that stuff is moving.
Yeah. So basically the part of this is have like, be smart about what you're doing, but have some faith in your abilities. And maybe you have to be like smart, stupid, like smart enough to not do something dumb, but dumb enough to take a risk that doesn't.
That's actually a great point, Jake, is that, you know, every time, I think only in hindsight, when you say, oh, I did a Kickstarter and I did $80,000, does it sound for sure? But when you're in the moment, and correct me if I'm wrong, aren't you freaking out every time, no matter what?
Every time.
I mean, this gallery, like I've got all this experience. And again, when I go through the list of these things, it seems like a no-brainer. I'm terrified and still moving forward. And it's important, I think, to know that that's normal.
I can't emphasize it enough. I don't think we're built this way. I don't think it's easy to say, well, that person's more entrepreneurial than I am, or I'm just not that entrepreneurial. I think it's something we train ourselves to do over time. You're either training yourself to do it or you're not, you know.
I couldn't agree more.
I noticed that I threw out the idea of this gallery to Will and Jake, and both of them jumped at it immediately. It didn't turn out to be the right time for Jake because he's doing some other stuff, but like immediately jumped at it. And I also noticed it on the last podcast when we did our intro, what we're talking about, and all three of us are doing these absolutely entrepreneurial things. I think you're right. You have to be trained that way.
But I want to add too, like growing up, I was always like, I liked the idea of it, but I always felt like I wasn't smart enough to do it, or I wasn't experienced enough to do it. And now if I were to show even like 10 year difference, Jake now from Jake in 2010, like I've learned so much just in these last 10 years that I had no idea was possible or available to me as the 2010 Jake Parker artist. He really was naive, and I hope that Jake Parker in 2030, you know, can sit down with Jake Parker 2020 and say, hey, look at all this stuff I've learned. You know, I've look at all this stuff that you thought you weren't good at, and there would be no way that you'd be able to do this. I've been able to figure out how to do it, and yes, you are capable of doing that. And that's like the big lesson I've learned in all this, is that if there's anything you feel like is out of reach from you, or you're not smart enough, or you're just not capable enough to do it, like you're honestly, like the range and smartness of people is not very big, and you could pretty much accomplish what anybody else accomplished if you've got you educate yourself a little bit. And I think luck is a little bit of component, like that has mm-hmm. to, I mean, obviously with this gallery thing, you know, if there wasn't a worldwide pandemic crisis, you know, this thing would be rocking and rolling right now.
It was working.
So there's a lot of factors that go into it, but don't let you be the stumbling block or the stopping block to trying this stuff out.
Hey, Will, did you always have the entrepreneurial spirit, or did it kind of come over slowly?
Like I said, it was a slow process. It was tough in the beginning, and it just got easier and easier. And it's still, when I look at doing something, you know, I'm because of the pandemic, I've delayed my Kickstarter that I was going to launch. And I think that was a good decision. I've already spent a lot of money getting ready for this, and I'm not worried. I really am not. I know that I have a product that people are going to want, and you know, it's hard to, in some ways it was hard to spend that money. I can just say I'm probably around $1,500 in, which isn't a lot. It's not too bad. It would have been a lot. But the fact that I look at money differently now, I look at it as a tool, and I want to have reserves so that I can make a decision. Like when you came to me with the gallery, you know, we were going to have to, and when I say we, because I'm kind of partnered up with another guy on my artwork, but we sat down and we made decisions. Could we afford to do it? Because we had to incur a bunch of costs. A bunch of printing costs, a bunch of packaging costs, a bunch of shipping costs, signage costs, and it all together, you know, and we actually spent a lot of that money too, getting ready. So we're really hoping you still open the gallery, you know, but it is what it is. We couldn't, no one could foresee this thing coming. But my point is that, in order to play the game of you know, making more money and having a better life and not having to punch a clock 9 to 5, you have to really look at money as I'll say it again, as a tool, where it's sitting off to the side waiting for that opportunity to come along where you can make decisions and you can make moves. And that's why I'm able to sit there and not panic, because you got to spend a lot less than you make. If you don't listen to Dave Ramsey or those who do get it, what he's constantly preaching is, you know, you spend a fraction of what you make. And that's not always possible. I've lived, you know, and I, more than anything, I know what it's like to not have money. And it's, I remember hearing people like me talk and going, yeah, that's easy to say when you have money. I've lost twice. I've lost two houses. I've been bankrupt. You know, I've worked my way back from the brink. So I know what it's like to not have anything and to be in a position where you can't, you don't have any reserves and you just can't make a move. And it sucks. But I did work my way back, and that was through making a lot of sacrifices. I live in a house that is a lot smaller than I could have. I drive cars that are older than I could. I could have newer vehicles. But I choose not to, so that I have these reserves. And hopefully one day, you know, as you're, you know, your spending should really lag way behind your income. And that's really the goal, right? Is to be able right. to look at money that way, so that eventually buying a new car doesn't raise your blood pressure one little bit. If you really want a new car, if that's the thing that does it for you, it's where to put it. And I remember having a mindset of, I will have made it when I can buy a new car. And this was like, gosh, this was like 25 years ago. My idea about money and wealth couldn't have been more upside down, you know. And I had that car, that van, repossessed. I bought it brand new, and it felt it didn't feel good driving it off a lot. It felt like, can I afford these payments?
Oh, you gosh, know, that's the rule, worst.
Yeah, now my rule is, if I can't pay cash for the vehicle, I don't buy it.
Right. And you guys can all do that, by the way. Look up Dave Ramsey if you aren't familiar with these kind of concepts. So a lot of people do it, and they do it under every kind of economic situation, whether you're a, you know, working as a server at a restaurant, or whether you're an illustrator, whatever you're doing. You want to hear something funny? As I've always had this ridiculous level of entrepreneurship, even when I don't have the resources behind it. I don't know if I told you guys this, but I somehow, right when I had started Art Center, I somehow got a deal where I was getting art supplies at wholesale at a local art store in Los Angeles. And I realized, I can't remember. Somehow they thought I was buying, maybe I was buying a bunch of supplies one day or something. Oh, I know. There was a pencil I used to use, a Ritmo charcoal pencil, and they were going out of business or changing business, and they were going to change their pencils. And so I went in and bought a case of them. Yeah. And somehow through this transaction, I got to be listed as a store at the place. So I'm buying wholesale. And then so I realized at Art Center that I could get all the materials that people wanted for the classes at Art Center for half of what the Art Center store's starting. So I started, I don't know if I got to get beeped on this, but it's least cheap ass art supplies. And I sold them out of my car. Lisa always talks about that. She's like, I have like four recurring businesses, and they all come back in different versions as I move forward. but that was one of the first ones. And I got shut down by the Art Center store because, they didn't want me to.
They're like, their little chart, their sales chart is just like taking a nosedive. Yeah, what like is going
these,
on?
All these kids have newsprint for the figure drawing classes, but nobody's buying them from us. Like, I can't remember. It was so hazy. But then I remember the Asaro head, you know, when you're learning to draw a head, it's the planes in the face, that sculpture. Yeah. Well, the only one they had was this giant big, you know, it was like an 12-inch tall ceramic sculpture that would break. And all these students are struggling to they either can't afford it, or you got to bring it to school carefully, otherwise you'll break it. And so I sculpted basically that head, but 6 inches tall, and then five other head. I had a six pack of heads that you could buy that you were transportable.
What were they made out of?
They were going to be made, well, I made the cast out of clay. Mm-hmm. And so I got them all ready. But of course I didn't have any money. I didn't know how to do that. It was just my idea. I came home and I was going to sell a six pack of heads. It was like 6 months of me trying to do this. It didn't work. I didn't have any money, but it's so funny because like 2 or 3 years ago, I went to an art store and there's a six pack of heads that you can buy. And I was like, oh, I knew that was a good proof of concept.
It was right one of there. Your classmates.
maybe. But I don't know. I've always kind of dabbled in these like funny things. I try to find a glitch in the system and I try to exploit it.
You know, it's funny. Go ahead, Jake.
I was just going to say, when I was in junior high, everybody was like looking at my drawings and be like, you're so good at drawing. And then one day one kid was like, dude, draw a tattoo on my arm, will you? And I was like, yeah, I'll do that. So I drew a tattoo on his arm, and other kids saw that and they're like, oh, you did that? I want one. So I realized, like, oh, I got to start charging for these. So I was like, yeah, 25 cents or 50 cents. And then I ended up making like this sheet of the 10 different designs that I would do and how much they would be. Yeah. And then I went around with that and people were like, hey, I heard you draw tattoos. I'm like, yeah. And so I'd open it up and they'd point at one. I'd pull out my markers and I'd draw it. And
That's great. See, that's the beginning of where you are now. It's funny because there's all these little steps.
And I guess too, like, well, you're saying like, how do you learn this stuff? I think a good point is like, if you're in the position to have a child right now, or you have kids, like, start training them to think that way. Like, what can you do to make money with the resources that you have? We do that with our kids all the time. Mm-hmm. And like my daughter, one day she like saved her candy from Easter or something like that. And so she had all this extra candy, and when the kids had already eaten all their candy, she's like, oh yeah, you could buy this off of me for a quarter. She came home one day with like $2. And we're like, how'd you make that? She said, I started selling candy. And so my wife was like, well, why don't we take those $2 and we go buy some more candy at the store, and then you could sell that and make $4. And she's like, oh, you're right. Anyways, she went into business with this other girl who had the same like idea as her.
That's fantastic.
The two of them together made over $100 that semester as third graders making candy or selling candy.
Well, I was going to tell you, that's what I did with my son. He was like, Dad, could you bring us a Little Caesars pizza to school? Because, you know, we have lunch, just when he was in high school. And I'm like, tell you what, you know, because he was like, we all just want a Little Caesars pizza, you know, like it'd be the best thing. A couple of parents have done that. And I'm like, what if you take it and take one and you buy it from me, you know, give me the money and I'll buy it. Because I taught there and I'll bring it when I come for my class, which was in the afternoon, and you can sell them for $2 a slice. So that's what he started doing. It was like they were just gone. People would just mob him with $2. For a $5 pizza.
That's so funny.
Until he got shut down.
Of course.
Yeah, he doesn't always get have a food license, right?
But I do think that, you know, speaking to kids and how they learn this stuff, they even from a young age, they have the aversion to the spending part of being in business. Like my kid did the classic lemonade stand, and he planned it for when parades would pass in front of our house in Portland, which was perfect. And it's hot and parades coming by and he's selling a ton. And then the next year he made a ton of money doing that. And the next year we're like, okay, we're going to try to teach him about business. So now he has to use his own money to buy the original supplies. And he's like, no, this is way less fun. He did not want any part of that side of it. And, you know, fast forward, this is exactly what we're talking about when I'm asking artists who are professionals to join a gallery where they can make so much more money and spend so much less and still have the same aversion to it. Let me ask you guys a question. I don't know if we're running long or whatever, but I think this is super interesting. Have you ever gambled on something like run, you know, the risk assessment, that's whatever's comfortable for you, and then it didn't work out? You know, I mean, you had to close up shop like I'm doing with the gallery. Anything happen like that?
Yeah, but they're too painful to talk about.
They're good to talk about though, because you know, it's not always going to work. It's not a fail safe. Right. I mean, I've got the six steps now, but and everybody's got to run their risk, but it's not foolproof.
I'll tell you about one of the least painful ones.
Sure.
And then I've got one too.
So me and a friend decided we were going to trade futures on the S&P E-mini futures.
So this isn't art related.
No idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, we were going to try to trade stocks. Because I was like, I work at home. I'm illustrating. I could watch the market at the same time. You know, we had this idea and we had this. It's a long story. I won't go into it where we got the system and everything. But the system we bought didn't work for me. And learned along the way that there's all different ways to trade. And you have to find a way that doesn't raise your blood pressure. And the way that we had bought just did not work. But there was another way we could do it. So we started doing this other system that sort of worked. And long story short, I met a guy who was an expert at trading, and he basically said, I'm on the other side of your trade. I'm always going to win. You're an illustrator. You love to illustrate. I love to read about companies, and I love to read about why the market goes up and down. And that's what I study all day. And I can't get enough. Do you read all those articles and everything? I'm like, wow. No, I can't stand it. And he's like, I'm going to beat you. And guys like me are going to beat you. And how, he's like, how much have you made? And luckily we had basically pushed, we earned just as much as we had lost in the market after about 9 months. And he's like, if I were you, I would concentrate on illustration. And it was a great wake up call. I donated a lot of time. So I really lost a lot of money because I spent a lot more time than I thought I was going to spend doing this. And it was a good lesson on doing what you're good at and what you love, really leaning into the thing that you love and not just trying to, not trying to do something just for the money was really the takeaway that I got there. But yeah, that was a failure.
You know. I thought you were going to mention your app because I thought that was a good story.
Oh, right. The story app.
Did you have multiple apps? I thought you just had one app story the free one.
Well,
and then,
I did try more than one. Yeah. So that was a good one. And that's in the children's book area where I did these real quick. I did three little eBooks for Amazon. When eBooks were first, when you could first upload your own eBook to publishers like Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And I jumped on it. I hardly spent any time. I spent about 2 months of actual work making three different books. And so my cost was zero because it's digital, other than my time. And I ended up making right around $40,000 over the next two and a half, three years in royalties from the sale of those books. So it was amazing. So then I thought, well, if I could do those crappy eBooks that don't sell or that don't take any time, I'll really put some time into making some story apps for iPhone and iPad, and we'll just do really well with that. So we hired, I got a guy partnered with Rick Walton, who's a really good proven storybook writer. I illustrated it, hired a voice actor to do the sound files, and hired my son to do the animations. And so we put together this production, got starred reviews from Kirkus, which is the highest review you could get because Kirkus was reviewing apps. And it got 5-star reviews from three different children's story app sites, the top ones. Didn't pay for anything. They were good. They were really good. They were so much better than the eBooks that I made.
Right.
And didn't sell any. So spent 3 months time working on each one, did two of those, Gary's Place and Gary's Worms. And
did Gary's, they're both cool. I like them. They're cool apps, but, did you do the one and it failed and you thought, well, let's try it again and do this other one and maybe this one will work?
Yeah, well, the whole plan the whole time was to, because you can update a digital product, my whole plan was to do, it was going to be a series. It was going to be more than two. And that if I could hook people on a series at $3 a pop, I could maybe get a customer to spend 15 or 20 bucks over time on all of them.
So if you come out of the gate with two.
Yeah. So that was kind of the thing, was just don't even worry about the sales on the first one. Go right into production on the second one. And then at the end of the first one, you have an ad that takes them to the second one. And same thing, you know, the each one is going to point to the others.
Yeah.
And it was a great idea, I thought. Yeah. But people didn't spend money on story apps. And I had one at one point. A mother that was a friend on Facebook said, because I was complaining on Facebook that I wasn't getting any sales. And she's like, and I had put my app on Free App Friday, which is a promotional tool to get your app out there, to get your downloads up in the App Store, which whether they're free or paid, it didn't matter. You would get a higher ranking if you got your downloads up. And so we did that, and I got like 9,000 downloads one day, 12,000 downloads the next day. You're only up for 3 days, 15,000 the next day, and then you put it back for $3. And my sales went from like 15,000 downloads, or my downloads went from 15,000 downloads to 20 downloads when I made it $3. And then the next day it was back down to 5 downloads and then 2 and 1 and 0. And that's I so had rough. A mother on Facebook that said, well, Will, we all knew you were going to put your app for free eventually. Everyone has to do that. So we just waited you out. And it was so frustrating. It was so frustrating to hear that.
Oh, man.
So that was a failure. But it was a success. It was a success in the creation of that product.
Right.
The product was.
And I think all that, every time you run through some of this, there's going to be some of those takeaways that are just fantastic. Like you got some good points out of that. You figured out some things that ultimately didn't work. But then you go to the next thing and all of a sudden you can use all that. Mm-hmm. What was your story, Jake?
So this just happened actually back in October, November. So the last 2 Inktobers prior to 2019, I had done a drawing a day on a single piece of paper, and it was a new character, and each character was a part of this sort of caravan of characters walking somewhere, and I called it the Traveler series. So the first one was Travelers of the Five Kingdoms. It was all sci-fi or fantasy characters. The second one was a sci-fi one, and it was the Intergalactic Travelers. And those 2 years, I sold, like 200 prints, and in November, 200 or 300, and just really like made kind of a killing on these things. You know where this is going, so. In 2019, I thought I'll do the same thing. I'm going to do my Skyheart characters, and I did the whole thing exactly the same way, and I launched it, and I don't know what I did wrong. Maybe my timing was off. Maybe people were like, we don't need another print, and I just exhausted the fan base that was into prints, and they're like, we've already got 2 long ones, we have no place to put this other long print. So they're like long and skinny, kind of landscape, double landscaped, and I barely broke even with that one. Like I realized I wasn't making enough money on these, so I thought, well, I'll print them myself. So I bought rolls of paper and the roll attachment to my printer to start printing. No, you know what? I didn't realize. What I realized was I wasn't going to get them back in time for a show that I usually sell them at. That's what it was. So I bought this roll thing so I could have some to bring to the show. I took them to the show. I only sold like 3 of them. And then the sales were down online as well. And I just barely scraped by to make back the money to pay for the roll attachment to my printer and the money that I paid the printer for all the prints. Now, in the long run, I got a bunch of them. I'm going to sell them over the next couple of years maybe, and I'll sell a few from time to time, and that'll be good. And if I launch a book 2 for Skyheart, that'll be an offering. Maybe I'll take them off my website and bring them back on for that. So there's still money, possible money tied up in that. But for all intents and purposes, I'm just looking at it as like, I'm going to cut my losses and not stress about it and move on to the next thing.
I really love that horizontal landscape. I mean, the super long horizontal skinny. Do you think that people looked at it and said, I got to get a custom frame.
Yeah. I think if I had a framed option, that would be different. I think Lee's right. Like if you can just size your artwork into something that someone can just go to Target and buy a frame for it, you're more likely to sell it or IKEA. If you could fit an IKEA frame,
And if you guys want to check out our show notes here, I have a whole document on standard size frames and what the artwork that corresponds to that frame is with a mat.
Yeah.
I'll include that if you guys want it.
So I think moving forward, my print game, I'm going to take down all the prints on my shop and start making stuff that looks better on a wall. Cause right now all my stuff is like, it's perfect. I think for like a man cave or like a dorm room or something like that. And that's fine. They'll have their place, but I don't know. I kind of want to make something that someone can hang in a kid's room or a living room or something like that. And so just make something that has a little bit more visual pull to it, maybe, and less of, I think the people buying my stuff are putting it up there for inspiration for the work that they're creating. And I'd like to make something that they're just like, this looks cool, I want to have it on my wall, and have it be like a part of the ambiance of what I'm trying to create in this space, you know?
Mm. That's cool. Well, what I love about all this is you never totally figure it out. It's always kind of a moving target. And, you know, each time you have to roll the dice on whether something's going to work or whether it's not going to work. And it's obviously not all going to work. And what I love about what both you guys said is, you know, you did it, you tried it, then you adjust from it and then you move on.
It's a fun game. And I have to say this, the failures actually make the successes so much sweeter. Mm-hmm. You know, if everything mm-hmm. just worked out, life would be so boring. But when you're in the project, you never want a project to fail. But you can look back at your failures and go, I'm really glad that failed because I made more money on this other one from the lessons I learned from that one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know.
God, it's so uncomfortable though during the time. I'll tell you this,
when it's failing.
The biggest show I ever got into as I was ramping up my art fairs was a show in Sausalito. Very difficult to get into. International jury and artists come to it. It's huge. And got into it. Just the booth itself was $1,500. Oof. Just the booth. And so, you know, we're in Portland. It's not close to San Francisco by any stretch. And we're driving down and we're over $5,000 in. And normally I'm not even close to that amount when a show's starting. So, mm-hmm. you know, my ultimate loss if a show went badly is, you know, $1,500 or something. That's, you know, I don't like to lose it, but it's low. And that we were all in. I just remember driving down, having a trailer full of art and driving down with all the prints and my wife and my son and just crossing my fingers, like bad weather could kill it. Anything could kill it. And I'm just sweating bullets as we're going down there. Turned out to be the best show we've ever had. But that feeling never goes away when you're rolling the dice. All right. I think we're ready to wrap up. Let me go through those six things. I got two more little things to add to it, but just to wrap up, how to evaluate risk. If you guys are thinking about starting something, if you're thinking about going to school, if you're thinking about changing something in your career, here's the way to evaluate those risks. Understand what the startup costs are for whatever change you're going to make and realize that that's going to be a part of it. Try to establish your proof of concept. Start small and then gradually work up if you can. That's a safer way to do it. Run cost and income projections. Worst case scenario, medium scenario, best case scenario, and be okay if it ends up being the worst case scenario. You don't, like Jake said, well, you don't want to lose your house if that's the worst case scenario. Have a limit where you're going to withdraw if it's not going to work. That's having a stop limit. Number five, understand opportunity costs. Spend time and money on high value items. And then number six, be okay losing a little bit in order to gain a lot and over time. And then I added two more little things here. Keep your expenses low. That's always going to help you, as low as you can. And how you do that is by sharing where you can. Team up with other people. Go in on a printer with somebody. Go in on a postcard with other people. If you can share, you can bring your expenses down. Anytime you do that, you bring your risk down too.
Cool. Good show today, Lee. Thanks for guiding us through that.
That's fine.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. And today, your hosts have been Will Terry. You can find his work at willterry.com and on Instagram at willterryart. Lee White at leewhiteillustration.com and on Instagram at leewhiteillo. And I'm Jake Parker. It's mrjakeparker.com and at Jake Parker on Instagram. Podcast produced by Aaron Painter. You can find his work at painterdraws.com. Podcast edited by Alex Sugg. You can find his work at alexsugg.com. That's Sugg with two G's. And podcast video for YouTube is edited by Daniel Tu. You can find his work at daniel2.co, and 2 is spelled T-U. Podcast, social media, all of our SVS social media handled by Lisa Fott. Special thanks to her. And if you like this episode, please share it around. Subscribe to us on your podcast listening app of choice. And if there's a possibility or if it's available to leave a review, please do so. A lot of podcasts live and die by reviews. And so we'd love to hear what you think about what we're doing here on Three Point Perspective. This particular discussion that we had today has its own thread on the svslearn.com forums. So go over there, and if you want to be a part of this discussion, if you have something to add, or maybe you got triggered by all this talk of capitalism, you can chime in over there and let us know what you think. And we'd love to hear your thoughts. There's always a vibrant discussion happening there, and that's where people disagree with us. That's where people add stories and their own anecdotes of what they've learned in their lives. It's always good times to hang out over there. So the forums, you can just go to svslearn.com, click on the forum button, sign up. It's free to join. Wonderful, safe community to share your artwork, to get feedback, to give feedback. Everyone is really well behaved over there. It's nothing like Twitter or Facebook or YouTube. All right, that's it for everybody. Thank you, and we will see you next time.